Hi, I'm Melissa Idris, and you're watching The Future is Female. This is the show where we find the extraordinary in every woman. Now, tonight on the show, we're going to be discussing how to transform workplaces into safe and inclusive spaces, particularly for women. Joining me on the show tonight, I have Amelia Sharif. She is the managing partner at Speak Up Malaysia, which is a consultancy that helps organizations change toxic environments, focusing on addressing sexual harassment, bullying, and whistleblowing in the workplace. So, Amelia, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, very exciting. Just talking about transforming toxic workplaces into safe spaces. So, I want you to perhaps explain a little bit about Speak Up and Speak Up Malaysia and its ethos. What is this Speak Up philosophy that you try and spread within your work?
I think very simply, we believe in a speak up culture. And when you talk about the speak up culture, you're talking about three components. The first one, you have individuals who are willing to speak up. Mm-hmm. And then you have leaders or people in decision-making positions who are willing to listen and act on those voices. And in the middle is what we say, a culture where people feel heard, people feel empowered. So ideally for us, it means creating a world or creating a workplace where people feel free to say something when they see something is wrong. They feel like, oh, I should alert my boss about this. Okay. Or when they feel like, hey, I think I know a better way to deal with this. They feel like they can actually go and say, hey, we've been doing it all wrong. I have a better idea. So Speak Up is something that is not just negative, because you're not just talking about complaints and all that. It is also about being really present and being involved and sharing ideas and all that.
Okay, so it's not just speaking up when you see something wrong, but it's also speaking up when you have ideas, when you want to contribute. I really love that, and I think in this show, in the next half an hour, we're really going to delve deeper into the three layers and how to create this environment. But first, tell me a little more about the Malaysian chapter of Speak Up, because about a year ago, I spoke to Anima Kosai,
yes,
who founded the Speak Up, and I think now it's based in the UK.
Yeah.
So how did you end up managing the Malaysian chapter?
I think it's all by chance. As all good stories start. So I think in Malaysia at that point, I was handling some cases and advising some organizations. And because Anima is based in the UK, so when she needs help for things that are based in Malaysia, she would ask me and a couple of other people to help her out. And I think over time, that sort of like developed into a relationship where we feel like, hey, we want to work together. And I feel like, hey, you know what, let's do Speak Up Malaysia. And that's basically how all this happened.
Was it because you saw, you felt that there was this growing awareness about needing to change the culture at workplaces, that it is, you know, time's up for this, right? Was that, did you feel like there was a little bit more resonance now?
Yes and no.
Oh, yes and no.
If you ask me, I felt this resonance like 10 years ago.
Okay.
Right? But it always is a process.
Mm.
And I think establishing Speak Up Malaysia is a step in the right direction, because we really want to focus on things like creating safe workspaces, creating a space that is diverse and inclusive, creating a space where people feel like, you know, I'm here 8 hours a day or more,
yes,
and that I matter here and my voices are heard. And obviously there's a lot of great organizations in Malaysia, like NGOs included, who are working on things similar to this. But Speak Up Malaysia is unique in the sense that we focus specifically from the perspective of an organization, in the perspective of a company, profit-making organizations,
okay,
and how do you balance out these various interests that you have without compromising your bottom line.
Okay, so you are looking at making organizations, you know, incorporate some of these kind of social justice values, right?
Yeah.
So not just looking at it from, say, a civil society organization point of view, but how do we make this practical? How do,
yeah,
we put, you know, processes in place? I really love that. But before we look to fix the problem, I think we have to diagnose the problem first. Talk to me a little bit, Amelia, about some of the topmost concerns that you see in Malaysian workplaces at the moment. What are the biggest concerns that employees have in the workplace when it comes to toxicity at work?
Based on my experience, if I have to rank top three, in no particular order, I would say it's discrimination or favoritism, the first. Second, I would say bullying, intimidation, vilification at the workplace. And the third one is harassment. And obviously when we talk about harassment, I'm not just talking about sexual harassment. We are also talking about other forms of harassment, like cyber harassment, like sometimes it's verbal and, you know, these various methods in which harassment happens. Underlying all of these issues is obviously about creating a culture where people feel safe and accepted.
Okay, so favoritism, bullying, harassment, and I'm glad that you made that distinction between sexual and other types of harassment, because often when we think about harassment, we just almost always gravitate to sexual harassment. But harassment has many angles and many forms of harassment. You mentioned cyber harassment a little bit earlier. What is cyber harassment in the workplace?
So I'll talk about harassment first.
Okay.
So if you want, like, I personally prefer not to define these words like the way we define things in the dictionary. So the way to go, I feel, is to find elements or ingredients that make something like harassment. So for harassment, usually we're looking at a situation where one party shows hostility or aversion towards another person or group. So the way this hostility is shown could manifest in various methods. It could be digitally, it could be offline, face-to-face, verbally, and all of that. And then you ask about cyber harassment. So cyber harassment is the kind of harassment that obviously happens digitally. I talk about this a lot because oftentimes employees, we don't realize that we're being harassed by our bosses, by our team leaders,
right.
Because they constantly text us 24/7. They expect us to answer our phone calls all the time, no family time. I need you now means I need you now kind of situation.
Mm.
Now, obviously employees, a lot of them, if not all of them, understand that sometimes, you know, bosses need something urgent because client give us a very tight deadline or, you know, things
project
just happen.
Base,
yeah. And, you know, they're more than willing to do this. But the problem is when this becomes a culture, you normalize the situation where I can text you anytime and every time, work hours, outside of work hours, and you have to respond to me. So that in itself is a form of harassment that happens digitally. For example, it obviously often happens via text or emails.
Well, this is really quite interesting because, you know, a lot of us, we don't even realize that's a form of harassment. You think that, well, this is my job, I'm going to have to do that, especially if it comes from someone in a position of authority. You think, I have to do this. Very interesting. Emily, we're going to take a quick break, but let's come back and unpack all of this. So much to cover on The Future's Female. Stay tuned. Thanks so much for staying with us on The Future's Female. I'm Melissa Idris and I'm chatting tonight to Amelia Sheriff. She is the managing partner of Speak Up Malaysia, which seeks to empower employees at all levels to speak up when they see something that may harm themselves or the organisation. Amelia, you said a little bit earlier just before the break about, you know, favouritism, bullying and harassment. And I'm wondering whether this kind of toxic behaviour almost always comes from someone in a position of power. And I say this because Malaysia in the past has topped the
Power Distance Index.
That's right. So we were actually at the top of that ranking. We had the highest power distance of any country in the world. And I'm wondering whether that has permeated to every level, whether that's permeated to offices and the workplace and, you know, corporate organizations.
Yes, definitely. Power distance exists in families, in homes, in social spaces, but especially in the workplace where there's actual hierarchy.
Mm.
And obviously when it's like, you know, there's bureaucracy and everything, it's like, you know, you have a organizational chart and all of that. This is sort of like structures that allow power distance to manifest and become a lot worse.
Mm.
So power distance, essentially, I mean, for the benefit of the viewers, is a situation where there's a huge disparity between the people in power versus the people at the receiving end.
Mm.
So the easiest way to understand power distance, if you ask yourself, in an organization, if you make a decision that impacts certain group of employees, let's say it's the lowest employees like executives, are their feedback, inputs, opinions taken into consideration? Or do you operate in an organization where no matter what the bosses or the leaders decide, you working class people, you just operate based on what I say, based on my instructions, make it work,
okay,
kind of situation. So if that's a situation, that means there's a power distance,
right,
in that organization.
Is that inevitable that, you know, there needs to be a certain amount of power distance, especially in organizations that have these really strict hierarchies where bosses are accountable for really, you know, important decisions, financial almost always? Is it inevitable that there needs to be a power distance, that they have to make decisions in the highest echelons of power?
I think power is inevitable. Because like you said, accountability. Some people just have a large scope of responsibility, so obviously they are a bit more careful with the way certain things are done. But power does not automatically translate to abuse of power. The same way like conflicts and disagreements at the workplace doesn't automatically translate into bullying and all that. So power doesn't automatically translate into a situation where there is a power distance, like a huge one at that, right? And I think there are things that you can do at the workplace that can, I think, reduce the power distance between those in power and the people at the receiving end. Okay.
Why is it important that we address toxic workplace cultures? I'm just thinking about, you know, many organizations that have operated for years with this toxic culture and pay no attention to it because everyone lets it happen. And more often than not, only pay attention to it when there's a crisis, when it erupts into a crisis.
Yeah.
So why is it important for organizations not to address it before it becomes a problem or even to acknowledge that there is a problem?
The first thing is because it affects your bottom line. And I mentioned that first is because I think the business case is most persuasive to organizations. If you expect employees to work in a situation where they feel stressed out all the time, they're depressed, they have massive anxiety about their work, what do you think is going to happen to the level of work that they do, to their productivity, to the quality of work or the output that they give to the organization? Even if they can take it at first, it will, you know, reduce over time.
Okay. There is an impact.
There is an impact because, you know, happy employees work better. And, you know, generally, and happy employees also become happy husbands, happy wives, and all of that. It impacts your personal life too.
That is absolutely true.
And I think more importantly, if you don't address it, it translates into mental health issues. And I think last year they like released a big number about if you don't address mental health issues in the workplace, this is the cost of that into that organization. This means that you probably have to spend more money to recruit people because people coming in and people leaving the organization is, you know, at a high rate. And secondly, you have to retrain these people, you have to, you know, spend a lot of money for onboarding and things like that. In an organization where you can limit this operation, where you can retain talent, obviously you get to minimize your cost in that aspect.
Okay, all right. So since we're talking about the business angle, about, you know, the point of view from the management angle, the board of directors angle, you mentioned three layers. You mentioned in the beginning of the interview, individual, leaders and culture, right? Let's look at the leaders part. What can leaders do to perhaps reduce this power distance, perhaps provide, you know, have the tools to listen to these complaints or these concerns when it's being raised to them? Because often, more often than not, you know, people are afraid to go to their bosses with problems because bosses don't listen or don't want to listen or don't want to know. What do you say when you work with them?
The first thing is before you even give them the tools to, you know, processes or whatever to help them listen to these voices, they need to have the willingness to do it. And this willingness have to be shown and not like lip service, right? Where you say, oh, you know what, your voice matter. You know, I always say my door's always open. All you have to do is just knock. You guys never, you know, come and say anything to me. But obviously the situation is multi-layered and a bit more nuanced than that. I've had an experience in an organization where the boss fully believed that he or she practice like an open door policy. Mm-hmm. Anyone can come and give me feedback and all of that. But when you actually assess the situation on the ground, people feel like they can't do that because they have this fear that this person, this boss, will ridicule them. And this stems from the fact that this boss, in a meeting, when they hear about someone in another department complaining about something, this person will ridicule situations like that.
Okay.
Oh, just making a big deal out of nothing.
Right.
I don't know what's happening. You know, so things like that. So people watch you. And they learn from your behavior to really assess whether or not you're willing to listen to me. So you can't just say you're willing to listen.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I think
even though you say you have, you know, an open door policy that anyone can come to me and say anything, whether that is the, you know, what people perceive you to be is another matter. So assessing that to make sure that that is in fact the you know, the culture within the office. What do you tell these leaders once you've established that they have a certain willingness to address the problem?
Three basic things they can do. The first one is always ask for feedback. And I think as a leader, you always want to encourage your teams to give you feedback on either things generally or a specific thing. Mm-hmm. Most often a situation or a red flag areas that you already identify yourself. Mm-hmm. But sometimes you know that maybe in your team you have people of various background, different age groups and all that. If that's difficult, you maybe appoint someone to be, you know what, I will give you like an additional task. Your job is to observe me this week. And at the end of the week, you tell me what you think I've done good, what you think I've done wrong, what I need to improve on to improve the situation between us, me and, you know, the rest of the team. Or you could do it the other way around. You could have an ombudsman in the team. So if you really care, you can say, okay, so your job is to give me feedback at the end of the week, but here's another person. Okay, this person, everyone in this team likes and trusts this person. If you guys are unhappy with anything, tell this person, this unofficial ombudsman that we have in the team.
So it feels almost still at that level where you're telling your teammate something, but you know that that is almost like a stand-in for your boss and will be heard.
Yeah.
Wonderful. All right.
So that's the first one. Mm-hmm. Quickly, second one is include them in decision-making processes. When I started working, we all know too well the situation where your bosses bring you to meetings, bring you in discussions. You thought you were a part of it, but no, you're just there to take notes. Probably also, you know, the gender factor plays into factor here. But I think oftentimes when people get to work, they are excited. Fresh grads go into the workplace. I remember my first day, I felt like, oh my God, this is it. I'm so excited.
I want to contribute.
Yeah, I want to contribute. You know, all job you take, whatever it is in the finance sector, whatever you feel like you're going to give back to society, people are excited about their jobs. So include them in decision-making process in a way that is meaningful. That way, they feel invested in that job and in the progress of that organization.
Okay.
So it's not just about them, it's also about the organization. I love my first boss. He or she is amazing. I so love this organization. A lot of people I know have such a soft spot for either their first organization or some organization because it teaches them something or it gives them some room for growth.
Right.
And people love their workplaces, you know?
They want to feel a sense of belonging.
Yeah.
And number three, did you say so?
So the third thing is, this is a bit more tricky to do because it involves a bit of working together with other departments. So I would also suggest work with HR, work with your risk and compliance department, work with your legal department, and identify specific trainings that you think you need as a leader or that you think your team needs as a leader.
Okay.
Speaking up is a skill, so you need to teach those things. Listening and acting on the voices of your colleague is a skill. So you can be trained on all of this, since it's what Speak Up Malaysia does as well. So, you know, identify areas, talk to your, and oftentimes HR also know, you know, how to do this thing.
Right.
So
well, that's what they're there for. They want to help. All you have to do is reach out. I really love that. Speaking up is a skill. All right, Amelia, another quick break, but we'll come back and continue this conversation. Stay tuned. Welcome back to The Future is Female with me, Melissa Idris. I'm speaking to Amelia Sheriff, Managing Partner at Speak Up Malaysia. Amelia, we were talking a little bit about what leaders can do to create, to create safer spaces from a toxic workplace. But do you have to be a leader to affect change in a toxic workplace?
Obviously, every single one of us at a workplace play a role. Mm. Unfortunately, those in decision-making power is the one that's, I think, has the biggest role to play.
Okay, can make the biggest change.
Yeah.
Okay. What can individuals do to create a speak-up culture? Because, you can speak up for your colleague. You can speak up if you see something wrong. You can speak up if what you're observing doesn't resonate with your, personal values. How can you empower or encourage individuals at the workplace to do that?
Okay, this is very tricky. So when we look at barriers that stop people from speaking up first, that could be organizational, i.e. structural. Second, it could be cultural. And third, it could be personal. So the way you encourage them has to be multi-pronged as well. So first thing you do, you want to go in an organization, you want to make sure they have the policies, processes. That's like basic.
Okay. So that's just have the structure in place.
Yeah,
okay.
Have the structure in place. The second thing is you want to address cultural issues and like personal issues. A lot of the times people feel embarrassed to speak up. A lot of the times they feel like, oh, it's too confrontational. Or sometimes they feel like, oh, I fear retaliation. So what assurances can you give to people to tell them, if you speak up, even if later whatever you tell me is proven to be untrue, but as long as you raise something to me in good faith, I will listen and I will act on it. So that's first.
Okay.
And then you can actually train them in terms of skills. So this is like basic communication skills as well. Women in particular sometimes find it difficult to insert themselves at the workplace. Because of expectations that are placed. Sometimes, we carry traditional values at home into the workplaces and we expect women at work to behave a certain way.
That's right.
We pass comments or remarks to women. And all of these things you don't realize, but it creates this mindset.
Mm.
And it makes it difficult for someone to actually mentally come to terms with the fact that I have to say this even though I know they will make fun of me. I will say this even though I know no one else in this team care about passing remarks that are inappropriate. So that's like a barrier.
Okay.
So to train them to be able to do that means that you have to train them to overcome those barriers, which is very, very difficult to do.
And when you work with companies to provide this training, Amelia, have you seen successes? And I'm just trying to visualize, because we've normalized this for so long. We've normalized some, a certain level of toxicity in the workplace that we think it's normal, it's acceptable. When you work with these organizations, what kind of changes have you seen? How do you measure your success?
We measure success two ways. Number one, volume or quantity of complaints or feedback received. And second one is, I'm talking about like on the perspective of the employee speaking up. We have two. So volume. And the second one is like content. So when they speak up, are they still talking about the same things over and over again? That means, the issue is not resolved.
Okay.
Or are they bringing up new issues? So that could be a good thing, because that means now they're more vigilant into like identifying problem areas and
right.
things like that. So I can't say more cases means good or more cases means bad.
Mm.
You have to assess the content of those complaints and those feedback. Mm. From there, if you read those things, you will actually have a feel of where this organization at, where it's going. We usually start by giving them anonymity, or we can say like, I'm an independent consultant, I come in, you guys, whatever you tell me won't get back to the management
right.
in terms of names, but content-wise, I will report back. And then, I've gone into places where I was supposed to do a review on like harassment or bullying, and then people started complaining about all sorts of things. And then I came to the realization, I think a couple of years ago, that when you want to go into a workplace and tackle harassment, for example, you have to identify the harassing behavior and also behaviors that enable the harassing behavior, because it's always two-pronged like that.
Mm.
And usually when people are at that stage where they feel comfortable to like complain about anything, salary, promotion structure, this and that, that's when you start to also identify These are other areas in the workplace that actually make people feel like even if they complain, no one cares. So it's a lot of talking, a lot of engagements done in the right way to establish trust.
Amelia, we could go on for another hour. Thank you so much for speaking.
Thank you so much. I had such a good conversation.
Well, it's been enlightening, and we hope to have you back and talk to us more about this issue. But appreciate your time for today.
Thank you.
I'm Melissa Idris, and you've been watching The Future is Female. We will be back with another episode, same time next week. Thank you so much for watching, folks. Good night.